Now we're going to turn to a truth teller of a different variety, also a writer, Julia Alvarez, who's a writer whose novels include How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents and In the Time of the Butterflies. She's also a prize-winning poet, children's author, and essayist. She earned her master's in creative writing at Syracuse University, and after teaching at a number of universities, she came to Middlebury College in 1988 as a full-time faculty member. Her work has earned her numerous awards, including this year the National Medal of the Arts. Julia Alvarez, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And Happy New Year.
Yes. Yes. Let's hope it is going to be a happy one.
Well, you have had quite a year here in 2014. What did it mean to you to win the National Medal of the Arts and to go to the White House to receive this award?
Oh, my goodness. Welter of all kinds of emotions. Of course, just, you know, amazement. I thought it was a practical joke. Seriously. And great gratitude in, you know, so wonderful, already a reward in itself to be able to do the work that I feel called to do, what I feel is my passion, my calling. And then to get acknowledged for it, that's you know, that's icing on the cake. But also a sense of, I don't know, a sense of, you know, humility, because nobody gets to be who they are, and you realize that, especially at this stage of life, without the investment of so many people, you know, the teacher who stayed after school to make sure you were learning your English, the auntie who sewed you those homemade outfits to wear to school that you thought were awful because you wanted store-bought clothes like the American girls, you know, the all those investments. And somehow you get called to be the face of the acknowledgement, and you realize that you couldn't have gotten there without all these people. And so you feel, you know, you do feel that all those people go forward with you. And I guess the one I've most wished were still alive and could have been there would be my father, my papi, who, you know, was an immigrant at 45, had to start all over, was never sure he belonged here, was terrified coming from a dictatorship, escaping, didn't know if we would make it, if we would be accepted. And, oh, my gosh, I mean, he would have been blown out of the water to have been sitting, you know, in the East Room and seeing me go up there and get a medal. Oh, my God. It was, you know, it was huge. It would have been huge, especially for him.
Well, tell us a little bit about your family. You were born in New York City, but your parents moved back to the Dominican Republic, and your father, who was an opponent of the dictator Trujillo, was moving back to live in the country run by the dictator. Why did he do that?
It's a time in his life that I'm exploring now and doing some research on. He had been a student and was part of a disaffected group and had to leave in his early 20s. And he ended up in Canada for 10 years and then met my mother, another Dominican, in New York City. They married. He couldn't go back. The first two daughters were born in New York. And then in 1950, as a kind of, you know, smokescreen, elections were going to be held and in the Dominican Republic. And there was this sense that, you know, it was going to open up, the country was going to open up, and the brain drain, the people should come back. And, you know, my father had always been homesick and wanted to go home. And so I think that my mother's family, who were all there still, said, now you have a family, that family needs a context. And I think he felt that, I think he felt a pull that must have been very painful of wanting to go back to what was home. And just this inkling, he always said to me, I knew nothing had changed. I knew nothing had changed. But he did go back, and sure enough, nothing had changed. And he again got involved in the underground there And 10 years later, we had to leave in a hurry, he and his family. So I think it was, you know, I don't know what, I'm curious about what that moment in time for him was like, you know, of these opposite poles.
When you say he had to leave in a hurry, and this includes you as well.
Right.
What was the threat that you were facing, and how was it made clear to you that you were going to be in big trouble in the Dominican Republic if you stayed?
Remember, I was a 10-year-old. My sisters and I had no idea. I mean, you didn't talk to your children because anything they might say and repeat could cause trouble. I mean, could have the whole family taken away. So we just came home one day from school and heard that there was a big surprise. We were going to Nueva York. You know, the land toys came from and all this excitement of pack your bags and you can take one thing. And you know, the sense that something was really wrong, you could sense the tension, but nothing was being said. And I only came to find out once we were safely in the States. My father had been part of a plot that eventually did kill the dictator, by the way. And it was organized in cells of three. Someone would contact me, I would contact another person. That way, if a person were caught by the secret police, it would take time before the whole linked group would be, you know, taken away, and some could escape. And my father's two cellmates, as they were called, were caught. And there was a man then in the CIA in the Dominican Republic, and his name was Manuel Chavez. He was a Mexican-American, and they had sent him after they closed the embassy to the Dominican Republic because he knew Spanish. And he had befriended my father and the underground group, and they had promised them guns, you know, for the uprising that would take place after the assassination. And so through this contact in the CIA, when my father found this out, this contact managed to get us out, and just in time, because, you know, soon after, a lot more people from that underground group were arrested. So we were, I mean, that's why I say we left overnight, in the sense that we had to leave in a hurry. And I'm still, by the way, in touch with 97-year-old Manny Chavez, who now lives in Miami, Florida. I called him a few days ago. He knows. I call him and I say, if it weren't for you, you know, I wouldn't be here. But it was an incredible moment, you know, that he was able to get us out.
What did you think about President Obama's recent announcement of ending the diplomatic, you know, restoring ties with Cuba?
Oh, hallelujah, huh? I mean, come on. How long? The fact that it took this long is just ridiculous. You know, it just, you know, it's a Cold War carryover, and it was, you know, the couple of times that I had gone to Cuba to see what was going on there, you know, and what the embargo, what kind of world, you know, the people were not able to get, you know, things they needed. The place was arrested in night, sort of arrested in time, and I was delighted. And my theory is that now this president is going to keep surprising us. You know, I think that he lost everybody the election, quote unquote, and now he's got nothing to lose, except maybe to you know, move forward on a lot of the things that a lot of us have been waiting for him to do, and definitely, you know, lifting this embargo was one of them.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation today with Julia Alvarez, the writer in residence at Middlebury College and the winner of this year's National Medal of the Arts. In November, you had an article in the New York Times travel section about driving the border of your home country, the Dominican Republic, the border with the DR and Haiti. What does that border mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. That border, you know, we hear about troubled borders around the world, and, you know, we're such a little, in many ways, ignored country or couple of countries on that island that people don't realize that this troubled relationship between Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the island of Hispaniola culminating in 1937 with a little-known genocide, the massacre of 20,000 Haitians on the Dominican side of the border by the dictator, a genocide that never has been addressed or redressed properly by the Dominican government. And you think, well, but that was 1937. You know, the embargo, get over the past. Yeah, but the past repeats itself unless you face it and acknowledge it. And it's never been properly acknowledged. And sure enough, in 2012, a draconian law was passed in the Dominican Republic by the highest court in the land, which virtually denationalizes Dominicans of Haitian descent, going all the way back, retroactive to 1929. So that massacre mentality is still in the Dominican culture, in the Dominican psyche. And I was raised hearing about the enemy next door. When I was a little girl, if I didn't finish my supper, they would say, the Haitian cuco is going to come and take you away to Haiti, where they kill Dominican children and eat them. And so, you know, this kind of fear, visceral fear, is put in your head since you're very young, and you don't learn the history. And it took really coming to this country to find out about that massacre. And it was a poem by Rita Dove, our poet laureate, many years back, called Parsley, about that massacre, because the way that there are many dark-skinned Dominicans, and all the Haitians that didn't want to be massacred would claim that they were Dominicans, and the litmus test was to hold up some parsley and to ask them what that was. And the Haitian, because he speaks Creole, doesn't trill the R, so he would call it perejil, and the Dominican would say perejil, and that was the litmus test on whether or not they would be killed. And so she wrote a poem called Parsley. So it took me coming to this country to find that out. So I've always wanted to go to that border and see where does that hatred come from? What is that line that we say exists where neighbors turn into enemies? So that was when the New York Times called me and they said they wanted me to do a travel piece. It was during this law that had just been passed, and I just couldn't see myself writing a, you know, come to the Caribbean on your winter vacation kind of article for them. I said, I just feel like this is not a moment to be, you know, promoting tourism or visiting the country. I feel like this is a big and important issue that isn't getting airtime. So I would only do this if you let me do this trip that I've always wanted to do and write about it. And they said, sure. And so I traveled the border and wrote about that experience.
Describe what the border is like today. What was it like to travel it?
Well, it's in certain places it's very dramatic in terms of the landscape. You look to the west and it's totally eroded, decimated, treeless, you know, really a kind of wasteland. And you look to the right, and there are trees, and there's shade, and there's bird song. And, you know, we're not a rich country, the Dominican Republic, but relatively speaking, it's just a dramatic lesson in why we need to wake up about taking care of this planet. I mean, it's right there. But then as you travel deeply into the border, where very few travel, it becomes a wasteland on both sides. And you see that, you know, it's... the earth doesn't make distinctions. You know, tragedy happens in both places. And one of the things that also surprised me is how porous that border is. As one of the people that we met said, we're compadres is a term we use when you're the godparent of another's child. It's a very close and very sacred relationship. You call yourself co-parents. That's your relationship, as strong as blood. And as one of them says, we're even co-parents together. And many of the people that we met on the border, it's very hard to tell a Dominican and a Haitian. In some cases, it was very hard to tell them apart. They were mixed into families. And many of them will tell you that this ideology is a politics of the capitals. You know, this is people wanting that have something to gain by keeping this ideology alive, by taking everybody's eyes off the problems that are being caused by the corruption and the problems within our own borders by our own politicians. And it's very interesting that whenever there's an election going to happen, this thing gets really heated up. All the rhetoric about the Haitian invasion that's coming over the border and how we need to protect ourselves and that we're Dominicans. And, you know, and this gets cooked up in the national imagination and served out to everybody. And it's not really, people at the border know they need each other to survive. And so this is the thing that a group of us from the diaspora have started. Every October for the anniversary of the massacre, we started this group called Border of Lights. We go on that date to the border and we light it up with candles. We have songs. We have poems. We have a service. We do a community project over the weekend using Dominicans and Haitians, planting trees, cleaning parks, going to orphanages. But a core group of Dominicans and Haitians, and then enlisting people in the community. And we've done it now 3 years, and it's amazing. The people come. And this is the thing. I mean, it's given me hope that when we get off the grid, the paradigms, you know, the grids in so many instances are killing us all, you know. This political, ideological way that, you know, things have always been done, that the people, the grassroots things that can happen are really promising and very moving. So we've just decided we're going to keep doing this, Border of Lights, and it's growing and becoming something that the people on the ground are claiming as their own as well. And this is something we can do as a diaspora, because like I said, I had to come to the States to find out about the massacre. But then we can't just, you know, leave. I mean, the brain drain is an old concept as well. We can go back now. We have social media. You know, we have email. We have all kinds of ways that we can come back and, you know, reconnect and sow those little seeds that were sown in us because we were the ones that got the chance.
We're talking with Julia Alvarez, the writer in residence at Middlebury College, here on the Vermont Conversation. Let's cross the border and come to some things you're doing here in Vermont. Last month, you were part of a benefit for the Vermont group Migrant Justice. Can you talk about your history with that group and why you support it?
Oh, wow. That was something that, I, you know, I should say to be absolutely, you know, open about this. I'm no longer as involved in this organization at all. It was at the beginning when there were, all of a sudden, overnight, there were migrant workers in Addison County, and farmers, clinics, people were calling me up because they knew that Dr. Eichner's wife, that's how I was known in the community, she knew some Spanish. And, of course, you know, we don't have a big Latino population in Vermont, so you know, there was no like Spanish language office you could call. So a group of us who were Spanish speakers were always being called. And especially moving was when I was called into the schools, because many of these migrant workers would come with their wives or girlfriends. They would start families here, or they would even bring their children who were showing up at the schools. And here they were, these little kids that didn't look at all like the classic, you know, Vermont kid, showing up in classrooms, didn't speak English. They were terrified and traumatized because they knew that at any moment they could be picked up, deported. And then there were the little Vermont farm kids, and they didn't know why, you know, these people were, some of them, working on family farms, and the kids had been told to keep quiet about it, and they couldn't understand why, you know, their squeaky clean patriotic parents were breaking laws and why people were being deported like they were reading, you know, things that happened in, you know, Holocaust Germany, things, people disappearing and in the middle of the night, you know. And I thought, wow, we need a story to understand what's happening to us. And that's when I wrote Return to Sender, which was part of the reason that I ended up at the Migrant Justice. They won the award from the Peace and Justice Center this year, and I was there at the benefit that night. Because I'd gotten to know a lot of these families and doing the translation that I had done, and also then in writing the book. And the book, it was interesting because the book was then translated into Spanish, and I'm able to share that story, their story, with those migrant families who, you know, it was based on their stories and also on the stories of the Vermont farm families.
You know, it seems like a lot of the arc of your own story, from being from a Dominican family who then wins the highest arts award this year from the United States, and working with the migrants who are in Vermont, you have this insider-outsider perspective where you move constantly back and forth, and you do that often with the characters in your book, this changing of perspectives. When you, being in Vermont, what do you feel like is, the experience of somebody who is a person of color or who is from another community in this state that is not known for its ethnic diversity?
You mean, what do I feel about?
Well, when you see these, you work with these migrant families. You also work with students at Middlebury College.
Right. And many of them come from all over the world, you know, amazingly. You know, there's a little pocket here of people from that have come from other places. But, you know, I tell them I'm the faculty, one of the faculty advisors. Actually, they call me Madrina, the godmother of Alianza, the Latino Student Association here in Middlebury. And, you know, a lot of times they will say to me, oh, my gosh, you know, we are constantly having to educate people on who we are and diversity. And, you know, a lot of times people will make comments and I find them insulting. And I say, well, first of all, remember, this is not a diverse area. And you've got to get a very fine-tuned sensibility for what is curiosity. And there's something very sacred and holy about curiosity, because it means someone is trying to cross a border from their ignorance into understanding something else. And it's a clumsy process, and you make mistakes, and you don't know how to say things. But it is good-hearted. And so learn that distinction. And the other thing is we are the bridge people. And everybody in this world is becoming more and more that person, whether they want to or not, because of connectivity. But I also tell them that I think that being a bridge person, our sort of responsibility, our mission, our challenge, is to connect one place with another, and therefore create a kind of fabric of a human family that can coexist. So you're always going back and forth. And, you know, in Vermont, you can really feel that it's a long bridge sometimes. You know, I'll sometimes feel like it's time to go back to the DR because I need my hit of Latino culture. But more and more, you know, I remember when I first came to Vermont in 1981, I was living in Burlington, and the North End isn't what it wasn't then, what it is now. I mean, the diversity that we're finding now in certain places in Vermont. The census in the year 2000 said that there were 5,402, something like that, people of Hispanic origin in Vermont. You know, that's a city block in New York City. But now there are 500 migrant workers in the Addison County area. I mean, this is what I mean. We're not, our borders are getting increasingly porous. You know, even in negative things, we're finding out, you know, it's very hard to keep an Ebola virus out. Viruses don't honor borders. We're critically connected. And I think part of what you realize when you're a person from another culture, or you're a person that's the minority somewhere, is that it increases your responsibility, really. But it's a responsibility that we all have. It just highlights it for you.
Well, Julia Alvarez, in the minute we have remaining, can you share with us a New Year's resolution that you are making to yourself?
Oh, my gosh.
You still have a few hours to go, but I wanted to be the first to ask.
Yes. I guess I'm really going to have to think about that. I don't know if it's a New Year's resolution, but it's something that I'm really asking myself at this stage of my life, with the time left me, with whatever skills I've cultivated over a lifetime of serving an apprenticeship. How do I want to use that skill? How do I want to marshal those resources so that I feel like, you know, I'm helping the next generation that is coming after me? What is it that I can do? So that, you know, it's sort of what are the stories we need to be hearing to come together as a human family? And, you know, so it's those kinds of questions I'm at least asking myself and committed in the new year and the years to come to try to understand and to work with.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there as your New Year's resolution. Julia Alvarez, thanks so much for joining us on New Year's Eve here on the Vermont Conversation. And that does it for this week's and this year's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next year on Wednesday at 1 here on the Vermont Conversation.
And you are listening to the stations of Radio Vermont as we head along toward the 2 o'clock hour in the very latest world national news. 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, and serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond. It is now 2 o'clock.
AP Radio News. I'm Carlotta Bradley. The U.S. says a key terrorist has been killed in Africa. AP National Security Correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The Pentagon confirms an American airstrike Monday killed al-Shabaab's intelligence and security chief. In a written statement, the military says Talil Abdushakur's death will significantly impact the al-Qaeda-linked group's ability to attack Somali forces and U.S. interests. The Pentagon says unmanned aircraft fired Hellfire missiles at a vehicle carrying Talil in Somalia. The group suffered big losses in recent years, with the U.S. also taking out its leader in September. Sagar Meghani at the Pentagon.
Average U.S. mortgage rates are up slightly, but the benchmark 30-year rate is still near a 19-month low. Mortgage giant Freddie Mac says the nationwide average for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was up to 3.87% this week from 3.83%. The average for a 15-year mortgage also rose to 3.15%, up from 3.1% last week. More Americans sought unemployment benefits last week, but the number of applications remains at historically low levels. AP correspondent Josh Boak reports on global economic problems that could still interfere with job growth momentum in 2015.
This would include the broader global slowdown in Europe, the recession in Japan, and China.